Good evening. It's nice to see all of you. And it's particularly lovely for us to have the opportunity to welcome Bishop Schultz back to Camrose and to Augustana and to the Ronnie Center. I've been trying to think of how this actually works. And I am sort of in a way forced back to the birth narratives. You know, in Orthodox hymns, we have this marvelous, charming image of how Mary gives birth to the one who created her. Those of you who have forsaken Trinitarian theology will have a little difficulty appreciating quite what that means. But for some of you, at least, you are aware of the fact that Bishop Schultz was absolutely key to the creation of the Ronning Center. So we now welcome him as both the one who had vision and skill to propose to the provost the need, not simply as a recognition of the legacy of Augustana, although that is worthy in and of itself, but also looking at our world in the 21st century and seeing the gravity of all these issues that have to do with religion and public life, and the need in a public university to begin to develop the kind of conversation that sheds more light on this than it does simply deepen bitterness. So I'm particularly touched, really, to be able to welcome you tonight to speak with us. Bishop Schultz, as many of you know, was the national bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Canada, retired a few years ago, now resides in Nanaimo, but he continues to serve on the Advisory Council of the Lutheran World Federation and chairs the Council's Renewal Committee. A number of years ago in the airport in Toronto, Pearson Airport, I saw coming towards me, I was in the back area waiting for my plane, and I saw coming towards me the Archbishop of the Greek Orthodox Church. His name is Sotirios. His name was never changed when he was made a bishop, because he said, "David, how could I change my name?" Sotirios says, "David here knows." What is Sotirios, David?
Salvation.
He was named Salvation, so how could he change his name when he became a bishop? Although, as I pointed out to him quickly when he told me that, it would be quite unusual for a bishop to participate in anybody's salvation. Except you. But he came towards me, and I greeted him, and I looked at him, and he looked really sated and tired, and I said, "Bishop, what's the matter?" He said, "Oh, I just came from Montreal, that damn Greek community in Montreal. It's just unbelievable." I said, "Oh, yes, the bishop's crown, a crown of thorns." "I see your crown of thorns. But it has been lifted recently." "Okay. So it's lovely to see you here as well." And this evening is the first of two lectures that Bishop Raymond is going to give. The first one here tonight on love and fear in the Bible. And the second one tomorrow night at Trinity Lutheran Church in Edmonton. So you can come in pilgrimage to Edmonton. Love and fear in human relationships. So I'm delighted you're here. Look forward to thinking along with you, and appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
looks like a casual enough setting that I can take off my jacket, besides I'm warm. I didn't used to do that. When I was a bishop, my waist was 6 inches bigger than it is now, but now I'm feeling a little more svelte, and I don't mind taking my jacket off. Well, I'm delighted to be here, and I'm not sure that I played as big a role as David suggested I played in the formation of the Ronning Center, but it was one of the things that I requested as a committee of four that was eventually tasked with finalizing the negotiations between Augustana and the University of Alberta. And what was done with that request has been an absolute joy and delight to me, and I'm so honored to be invited to speak to you tonight. So thank you. So as David said, this is part one. Popular literature usually refers to love and hate as opposites. The problem that I have with that set of opposites is that it tends to limit love to an emotional response or some kind of sentimental feeling. And it involves subjective values like perception of beauty, desirability, agreeability, eroticism, satisfaction. These are what motivate our emotions. And then hate arises as a response when those satisfaction factors are missing or they are somehow misused. So a response of hate doesn't necessarily mean that the relationship is over, just that it falls short of emotional expectations. So my proposal in these two addresses is that fear and love are the real opposites. So the subtitle to these lectures is Love as a Way of Being Fully Human Apart from Emotional or Sentimental Feeling. So my proposal has implications not only for personal relationships, but also for ethical and religious and social and political relationships, all of which make up our human experience. The love that I'm going to define as I go along doesn't exclude the emotional aspects of personal relationships, quite the opposite, but it goes beyond them to a way of being human in which one can love the other even when the satisfaction factors are absent. Fear will be depicted as the primal desire to avoid or to destroy that which is seen as a threat and which should not be engaged because of the peril that it presents to the individual's personal survival. So fear terminates engagement with the other, either through abandonment or through destruction. No matter how attractive the other one may be in every other way. I was once involved in a mediation situation where the mediator taught me about the cyclone of alienation, and when you start out at the bottom of this cyclone, there are still ways to introduce outside factors, but as it goes up, the mind becomes more and more closed until you finally get to the top where it's mutual self-destruction. He said, I'll tell you an example. I was working with this man and I said to him, you know, if you go any further with this, you're going to be old and poor. And he said, yeah, but so will she. Fear terminates the engagement. So this first lecture, this lecture tonight, is going to focus on the way that Lutheran theology, at least my Lutheran theology, understands love as the theological foundation of relationships. And then the second lecture tomorrow is going to address a variety of relationships to which I will try to apply this view of humanity and examine it through the perspective of this interpretive lens. So, in the beginning, The implications of fear for a relationship appear right away in the founding documents of the Hebrew Scriptures. So we have this couple. The story is set in paradise where everything's pleasurable. And Adam finds a woman to whom he refers as bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. But then if we read on a little further, the story reports that there is an exchange between God and Adam that occurs after Adam has eaten the fruit of the forbidden tree. And God wonders where Adam has been, and Adam says, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. So the story goes on to describe that fear was what had ended this honest intimacy between humanity and God, and subsequently among humans themselves. So humanity, in trying to govern itself in a life alienated from this unconditional providence of God, finds that even the soil becomes unproductive, and competition rather than mutuality enters into their experience of trying to sustain their lives. Adam blames his wife for enticing him, tries to bluff his way out of his choice to break his trust with God. But in spite of Adam's bluff, God does not remove the providence, but without the bare naked intimacy of this fully shared life, Adam's attempt now to imitate God, to replace God with his own will, is limited to his own solitary resources, without what otherwise was given free of conditions for the good of all. So then these are in the first three chapters of the book of Genesis. Then when we go down to Genesis 15, there's an exchange between God and Abram. Later on he was named Abraham, but at this point his name hadn't been changed yet. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram, I am your shield. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless? But the word of the Lord came to him, no one but your very own issue shall be your heir. He brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and count the stars, if you're able to count them. And then he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And he believed the Lord, and the Lord reckoned it to him as righteousness. Now, Abraham was not a perfect human being, but he was not afraid of God. His fear of being vulnerable never dominated his faith in God, and so that's why he was considered righteous. He was righteous because it was possible for God to remain in communion with him and to journey with him towards an unknown and an uncertain future. It doesn't sound like a very mutual relationship. God seems to have all the power and freedom that the limited humans in the story do not. But you have to remember that the image of God depicted in Genesis was written in the context of a tribal and patriarchal society. And both domestic relationships and social governance in which those early scriptures were written reflect a very pre-democratic world. Yet even in that world, what was required of Abram was not perfect performance, was not mindless obedience, but trust that the creator of the universe was not anti-human. In the case of Abram, his honest self-disclosure led him to a relationship with God in which God chose to overlook his anxiety in order to keep working toward the promise of a world restored. God was not offended by Abram's behavior. God was interested in Abram's understanding that they shared the common attributes of being living beings. Humans, however, are creatures. They're no different from the other life forms on this planet. They're not made in heaven and flown to earth by storks. they arise. I'm sorry, did that disillusion anyone? They arise from natural processes the same as other creatures, and they exhibit the same kind of internal urges and drives as other members of their order. We're primates. As with all primates, they have the basic instinct that becomes activated when they are threatened, and that condition is referred to as the fight-or-flight syndrome. And it results in the threatened individual either destroying the threat or fleeing from it if victory appears impossible. That's why if you're out camping and you encounter a black bear, if you can look big enough, the black bear will not attack you. The thing about humans is that they consider themselves so terribly unique because humans have developed these large, lively brains and a capacity for self-consciousness. Humans have the ability to think about themselves as if each one of them is an individual separate, not only from the others, but even from the self that is doing the thinking about the self. They have the ability to think of themselves and others as objects rather than subjects of a story that they all share together. Humans have the ability not merely to experience themselves, but also to imagine themselves, to generate mental images that may or may not be corroborated by the experience of other people. Anybody who's tried to date someone who turned them down knows about that. The imagination can generate Pollyanna images of perpetual optimism, or it can also generate the sinister threats that lurk in every corner of a conspiracy theorist's mind. Carl Jung revealed that our minds contain an entire spectrum of images. We all have them, from the most beautiful to the unspeakably horrible. If that weren't true, Stephen King would never sell novels. The question is, what do we do with those interior images? Well, the thing is that even imagined threats can result in this fight or flight syndrome. So I'm not going to go into the complex of psychological and development factors that result in that kind of an imagination being formed, but suffice it to say that we've all likely experienced the phenomenon and know it to be real. You can experience it every day just by reading the letters that people write to newspapers. And so there are those who say that the leaders are terrible, they should be ousted from office, and others say, I'm not going to have anything to do with this anymore. And sometimes the emotional tone of the letters reveals how the fight or flight instinct produces such a rush of adrenaline that if it is not processed in a healthy way, it results in a state of hypertension, and it is filled with anxiety and anger and aggression. And the same syndrome underlies attitudes towards self and others, and it results in alienation and chronic fear and distrust and conspiracy theories and prejudices of all kinds and xenophobia. You know, it's the fairy tale about Chicken Little. He had the confidence that the sky was falling. The sky didn't fall, but he got the whole barnyard into a flurry anyway. So some church people are sure that we're destroying society by recognizing the rights of gays and lesbians, or tolerating the religious rights of new immigrants who are not Christians, and they see an insidious plot in all of this to convert all of our society to something else. That's what they see behind these acts of tolerance. See, the human species cannot be other than the order of creature it is. But it can sometimes put aside these more primal emotions or train them on a vision of a fuller life in communion. That's what I mean by the subtitle. So knowing that, the Genesis writers related a conversation between Eve and another animal about the possibility that the God of providence might not be their benefactor. Even though the premise contradicted everything that the primal couple experienced. So the couple concluded that relating to this God could be dangerous, could keep them dumb, subservient, and so they chose not to be trusting and not to cooperate anymore. And they abandoned the relationship that had encompassed their beginnings, and they chose to see God as something other, someone so different that they would not and could not relate and share life together anymore. They put that feeling ahead of their own experience and entered a state in which self-interest came ahead of a future that they might have shared. So individuality trumped identification with a common humanity. And what God needed from them was displaced by their imaginations. It's a great story. Who would ever imagine that God needed anything? And yet, Martin Luther's definition of a God is that to which we look for all good. Why then would we become alienated from that which we experience to be good? Perhaps it is because we have developed a way of imagining others as not good, at least not as good as we are. So that's the beginning. Now let's see if we can find an alternate humanity. As the tribal confederation of Abraham's descendants began to emerge as a state in the Middle East, it began to define other people as others, not them. That's what the term Gentile really means. It means not us. The Greeks used the term barbarians. It was a word that mimicked how they thought the speech of other people sounded. It was kind of an ancient Newfie joke. The next step was that the leaders of the tribal confederation of Abraham's descendants began to distance themselves from the rest of their own citizens. And even though the code of Moses established a covenant that required every human to be equally accountable to God, monarchs began to assume a mandate that set them apart from ordinary moral accountability. No longer was everybody equally equal before the law. And so in that spirit, King David had General Uriah murdered so that he could marry Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. Because he hated Uriah? No, to the contrary. David admired him. But David was afraid. David was afraid that his own leadership would be denigrated when it became known that Bathsheba was pregnant by him, not by her husband. And so it was fear, not hate, that drove David to abandon his love for Uriah. So it fell to the prophet Nathan to tell David a story about a poor man who only owned one sheep, but that sheep was appropriated by a wealthy man with flocks, so that he could entertain his guests at no expense to himself. And it was a story about not identifying with the common humanity of the other. So some members of the human family become capable of defining another group of people as a lesser priority than themselves in the priorities of life. Some members of some cultures see other cultures that way. You know, this is a school that had Norwegian heritage, And there's always been jokes between Swedes and Norwegians, depending on which one is telling the story. The other one is the same as them, except that their brains have been knocked out. You know, that kind of thing. And so defining oneself as distinct from the common human condition has effects on all kinds of relationships. Conjugal relationships, when husbands and wives treat each other that way, and cultural relationships, and commercial relationships, and political relationships. So even though the sins that are described in the scriptures often are those of powerful people, what has in fact turned out is that even those who are lowest on the pecking order can identify others who are less worthy and less than they are. So what it means to be truly human becomes subverted, and self-interest makes the needs of the other secondary. But the gospel of love was not lost. There were those who continued to believe that their God's true nature was found in the proposal that full humanity was experienced when one willingly honored the experiences and met the needs of the other. The opinions of these people are generally recorded most notably in the books of the prophets. Some of those prophets were champions of the underdogs, but others were influential spokespersons of communities of political opposition who could see the precursors of ruin coming up in the way that their leaders were aspiring to a politics of national self-interest. Now, that prophetic tradition had been a millennium in the making by the time Jesus was born. Rome was the current superpower by then. Israel was a vassal of that empire. And a complicated politics of wielding power and surviving power and surrendering the needs of the weaker to the advantage of the ambitious was fully in place. The writers of the various accounts of Jesus describe him, however, as someone who is fundamentally shaped by the writings of those ancient prophets. And so while Jesus' predecessor, John the Baptist, preached law and order revival sermons, thinking that the righteous could prevail through sheer moral superiority, Jesus was raising questions about the fundamental way that the socio-political system of his day operated. Jesus grew up in a hick town in Galilee. Nazareth was an armpit kind of place. I've been there, I agree. But Nazareth was a place where Jews and Gentiles lived side by side and had done so for generations. In today's terms, Jesus was an Israeli who was living in the Palestinian part of the country. Did Jesus consider the Gentiles righteous in Jewish terms? No, he did not. The Gospel of John describes Jesus having a conversation with the Samaritan woman at the village well, and he doesn't agree with her, either theologically or historically. But he recognizes her legitimacy as a human child of God. And he commiserates with her suffering because she's a humiliated person. Because she's a woman, and because as a cultural community, her people are being shunned by his. His conclusion is that neither his religion nor hers will resolve the social and the political divide between them. Something else will have to happen. And the resolution will come through the understanding that the spirit of what it means to be the people of God will transcend all of those social, political, and theological myths that are invoked in order to keep defining the divisions. The story contains all kinds of complexities of social disapproval for both Jesus and the woman. Jesus' disciples are scandalized by him as well. They ran the risk of shame and disapproval, Jesus and this woman, and yet neither avoided the other nor denied the other their need for a common humanity. And it wasn't a friendly conversation, it was very frank. In another story, a Syrophoenician woman, a Gentile, refuses to let her outsider status silence her plea on behalf of her daughter's health, even though they say, shut her up and get her out of here, we're having dinner. See, the fear that their way of life might disappear has led people to dissociate themselves from others, or if they think they have sufficient power, to dominate or destroy them. Do you know how many overlays there are of peoples in Europe? Remember what happened when the Balkans re-Balkanized and 600-year-old feuds came to the surface again? Well, the recent Winter Olympics were a reflection of that phenomenon too. The athletes probably experienced a lot of friendship in the social life of the residential village, but on the slopes, they were champions of a political order. That political order expected them to show superiority of the national and the cultural states that were sponsoring them. So I read yesterday, the day before, in a paper that the gold medal winner from the Chinese team was criticized because she didn't thank her government. On the other hand, we Canadians are all proud that once again we own the continent. Just barely. The Gospel of Matthew recounts a discussion between Jesus and Peter about forgiveness. And so Jesus tells a parable about two debtors. The first is a minister of the king who owes his monarch an unrepayable amount. But when that minister appeals to the monarch for time to make recompense, the monarch shows him grace. The second one is a lesser person who owes this minister of the state a small amount. But that forgiven minister of the state refuses the same grace to that person that he received, and he has him thrown into debtor's prison. And when the king hears of his minister's cruelty, then he withdraws the grace that he first extended. So Matthew's conclusion is, so my heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or your sister from your heart. And you have to understand, this isn't saying that you do bad and God will do bad to you. This says that if you act inhumanely, you create a whole inhumane system that keeps replicating itself. So both debtors owe what they owe. There's no question about that. But the gospel is not interested in that kind of righteousness. It's interested in human necessity. What does it take to be a human being? The right to humanity resides not in moral perfection, but in having been born. Nor is the gospel primarily about gratification. Whether the other person is pleasing is not the basis for love. The only basis for love is the needs of the other. Since the other is other only culturally and aesthetically, I don't like the way they look, how they act, I don't like the group they belong to, the common human needs of the other call for the development of some kind of symbiotic relationship. Not everyone is born to equal socioeconomic or formational or intellectual equality, but everybody is born to the same hopes and drives and needs as those who are at the top of the food chain. By now, probably everybody knows about Abraham Maslow's old hierarchy of human needs, and this is an old list. But he starts with biological and physiological needs. We all need air and food and drink and shelter and warmth and sex and sleep. And many of these are on the list of our environmental concerns. And then there are safety needs. We need protection from elements, security, order, law, limits, stability. And then belongingness and love needs. So we need to belong to community, to work groups, to families, to have affection and relationships. And then esteem needs, where achievement and mastery and independence and status and dominance and prestige and all of these things are recognized. And then finally, self-actualization, where a person is able to realize their personal potential and their self-fulfillment, and to seek personal growth and have some peak experiences in their life. The big question is, what kind of a society does it take to ensure that every human being is treated as equally human by every other human? God's covenant with Israel is a covenant of grace. The Israelites were not liberated from Egypt because they particularly deserved it, but because they needed it. Paulo Freire, back in the 70s, observed the same thing in Latin America when he talked about God's preferential option for the poor. And he said that God did not have a preferential option for the poor because they deserved it, but because they needed it. And that principle is recognized also in the Torah. So in Deuteronomy, we read, "You shall not withhold the wages of poor and needy laborers, whether other Israelites or aliens who reside in your land in one of your towns. You shall pay them their wages daily before sunset, because they are poor and their livelihood depends on them. Otherwise, they might cry to the Lord against you, and you would incur guilt. You shall not deprive a resident alien or an orphan of justice. You shall not take a widow's garment in pledge. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there." Now I'm moving on. The earliest Christian writings are those of Paul of Tarsus. They predate the earliest gospel by 40 years. He was a rabbi. Whatever else Paul understood about Jesus, one of the most cited characteristics in his letters is Jesus' agape for others. Agape becomes for Paul a formal principle of how Christians should live with others and with each other. Now, agape is one of several Greek words for love. Other Greek words include eros and philios. There are a whole bunch of them. Philios is an affection and loyalty toward neighbor and state and gods and so on. So philanthropy and all of those words come out of that definition of love. Eros is the desire for beauty in a person or in an object. And all of these words are used in the manuscripts written by Paul, but none is so preeminent as agape. Agape is a form of love for the other that arises out of identification with the other's humanity and the willingness to meet the needs of that other. So Luke's gospel records a parable of Jesus about a Jewish mugging victim whose unconscious body is ignored by his own citizens but is given free health care by a Samaritan, a people who the Jews shunned. I find it so ironic that the following passage is often quoted in church weddings. It's quoted as a paean of the love of the bride and groom for each other, but it's anything but that. "If I speak in the tongues of mortal and angels, but do not have agape, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have agape, I am nothing. And if I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have agape, I gain nothing." Those are childish. "When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways." "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, but then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and agape abide. These three. And the greatest of these is agape. Those words were written to a congregation. They were written to a congregation that had allowed financial resources to create a class structure within itself under which the well-to-do gorged themselves on the love feast of the Eucharist, and they left their servants to scraps, even though they were all sisters and brothers of Jesus through their baptism. In other of his letters, Paul went on to observe that this failure of agape had undermined not only the integrity of the Christian movement as a religion, but had consequences for their domestic relationships of their members as well. And so he wrote about relationships between husbands and wives, and parents and children, and employers and employees, and he also wrote about relationships with the government. For Paul, the agape revealed by Jesus formed the foundation upon which all these other relationships were to be modeled. Agape is a proactive approach to relationships that removes the need for both competition and fear. When members of a household or a community consent to enter into the experience of the others, then they become aware that the others have needs. And it doesn't require that every person be able to meet every other need, only that there is the willingness to do so. It's safe to be truthful, and it's safe to be vulnerable in that kind of a community or family. Because then competition is superseded by common shared welfare. Eros then can be expressed freely and become an experience of mutuality rather than the desire to own and exploit the beauty and desirability of another person. All of those philia affections for the various aspects of society can lead people to develop and work in networks of response for the good of the whole community. And self-aggrandizement and ambition can be superseded by the desire to create a nation that serves the needs of its people. So agape breaks this ancient cycle of aggression and retaliation that characterizes so much of our human history. It lies at the heart of the theology of the cross, which is one of the anchors of Lutheran theological thinking. Martin Luther and Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Douglas John Hall have written extensive and gripping treatises on this historical turning point. And I'm very grateful to Dr. Christian Eberhardt, who's a professor of New Testament at Lutheran Theological Seminary in Saskatoon, for his clear explication of this theology. And he did it by talking about the Eucharist. He said, "Our problem is that we no longer understand the meaning of blood in Hebrew thought. And therefore we misunderstand Jesus' words at the Last Supper and the meaning of his death." He said, we think of this as some kind of sacrificial death that was done on behalf of us all, and that Jesus was some sort of martyr, and so because of that now we're all free from guilt. But he said, blood in Hebrew thought is that which contains life. So to give one's blood to or for another is to give one's living self to that person. It is to give to another person one's own life for that person to live. And whether the blood is that of the Passover lamb or the sprinkling of the blood on the altar and the people by the ancient priests, the point is the same. God is giving life to God's people so that they may live. And God is giving people the gift to go forward and to create a society that witnesses to this life under God. So Jesus didn't absorb the sins of his people so that they could stand scot-free before the eternal judge and be deemed worthy to inherit eternal life and eternal bliss. Rather, sin is an attitude towards social relationships with which each person continues to struggle. Luther said we're saints and sinners at the same time. Continues to struggle with the desires and the self-interest that result in harm to others. And so Jesus turns that around and offers life to his people, a life free of fear, so that the society under God can go on in spite of sin. Jesus discovered in his baptism that he was God's child, the beloved. This he understood was God's gift to each human being. And life under God was for Jesus a life of unconditional grace. Fear was irrelevant. This relationship was based on trust. The idea of a God, however, is an abstraction and a theory and a metaphor. And love of God is a philia. It's an affection for an idea, but it is not a literal experience. Isaiah 55 says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." In other words, God is saying, you can think about me what you want to think I am and what I mean, but I am who I am. And John 6:46 says, no one has seen the Father. But then we go back to the God of the Abraham stories, and there God ceases to be an abstraction. And God enters into human history, into the birth of Abraham and Sarah's son, and the creation of a society, and God tastes human tastes and celebrates these human births and helps build human communities so that true, tangible, and mutual love of God only can be experienced by humans through engagement with other humans. And therefore, in John 14, it adds, have I been with you all this time, Philip, Jesus is saying, and you still don't know me. Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. And so Jesus lived his life as an embodiment of that trust, that we experience God in each other. The fact that religious and political leaders found him a threat and executed him did not diminish that trust. That's what he hands on in the Eucharist, generation after generation. Instead of burning with passion for a way of life free of fear, he sat down one more time for a last meal with his friends. And he offered his life to them as a way for them to continue into the future together. A future that St. Paul wrote was characterized by his agape. And that way they'd be able to continue their way of life in the Roman world of many religions, many gods, and the scapegoating of all of those that their political leaders feared. Ivan Illich commented in a series on CBC Radio that Nietzsche hated Jesus because he didn't believe you can build a culture out of people who he perceived to scapegoat themselves in the interest of others. In Nietzsche's opinion, every culture needed the story of a mythological enemy that was definitively defeated and therefore established the identity and the superiority of its way of life. That's why Americans celebrate the revolution every year. The ultimate corruption, in Illich's opinion, was the assimilation of the Christian church as the state religion of the Roman Empire. because then the church began to imitate the state's legislative and its contractual practices, and it made life under God a matter of obligation, and it made it a matter of fear for the survival of the soul. In fact, all the emperor could do is execute you, and once you were dead, the emperor had nothing left to do to you. But the church could make your soul suffer even after death and make you pay for a whole bunch of masses so that your grandma could get out of purgatory. Martin Luther, who opposed all of this, didn't understand morality or any of these behaviors that were obligatory as anything more than a way to simply sustain a social system. Morality could help to control social order, but it was not the key to fear-free trust in God. A smart priest could always find some loophole that you had missed. It was not, for Luther, a way to be righteous before God. Piety wasn't high on his list of virtues either. Holiness to him was the joy of a vocation that we are all given, under which we celebrate God's generous grace, and we reflect that in the way that we live in our community. Church observance was a way to receive the community's encouragement in a life that trusts in the faith that Jesus had. Luther supported marriage, but not because it was a holy thing to do. It isn't a sacrament in the Lutheran Church. Luther supported marriage because it was a human right. And it was a right that was being denied to the clergy by the enforced celibacy of the priests and holy orders. So he considered celibacy of the clergy the denigration of a human good. It's a community issue. Luther understood righteousness as a free gift of God. Righteousness meant to Luther the right as a human being to be in communion with God. And his list of human needs before God read a lot like Maslow's hierarchy. In his introduction to the Lord's Prayer, he wrote, "God wants to entice us so that we can come to believe he is truly our Father and we are truly his children, in order that we may ask him boldly and with complete confidence, just as loving children ask their loving Father." And then regarding bread for today, he wrote, "In fact, God gives daily bread without our prayer, even to all evil people. This includes the necessities and nourishment for our bodies, the lowest part of the hierarchy, clothing, shoes, house, farm, fields, livestock, money, property, an upright spouse, upright children, upright members of the household, upright and faithful rulers, good government, good weather, peace, health, decency, honor, good friends, faithful neighbors, and the like." And then finally he sums it up really nicely in his explanation of the commandment not to kill. "We are to fear and love God so that we neither endanger nor harm the lives of our neighbors, but instead help and support them in all of life's needs. And fear as in we are to fear and love God means respect and honor." In a historical setting where fear of corrupting one's eternal destiny was a constant and tangible fear, Luther found freedom in this gospel of grace. He didn't romanticize love, but he understood it as the willingness to meet the needs of the other. Fear, on the other hand, erases that willingness and leads to a repressed life. Well, that's it for tonight. Tomorrow I'm going to reiterate the basic premise of tonight's talk and then describe how I see it as operative in historical events. So you're probably asking, why couldn't he have done it that short tonight? Well, I didn't, but you're still here, so thanks for your attention.
Can we talk a little bit about this? Who would like to pick up on some aspect of what the bishop has laid out for us? It looks like Dietmar Mundl found it more than he could. He has to sing. Who would like to pick up on it? Peter.
Yes, this is very unusual
for me to be the first.
It's very unusual. I've never known Peter to do this before.
I was intrigued by your quotation from Professor Eberhardt because we attended a retreat which he gave, in which he expounded quite a bit on his understanding of this whole atonement theology and the paschal sacrifice and blood and so forth. And I would be interested in hearing what your thoughts about this in the light of, just expand a bit on your concept of love and giving of oneself, giving one's life, and fear the estrangement. I'm not Lutheran, so I'm not terribly familiar with Lutheran theology, but just in terms of Luther's understanding of righteousness and giving of one's life.
Well, Lutheran theology does also contain atonement theology. And atonement theology is the idea that God holds court and that sinners are responsible for their sin, but that Jesus, as a completely righteous person and as the Son of God, could give his life as a substitute for the penalty for everybody else. And so then faith in Jesus becomes essentially an event of claiming identity with him so that on the day of judgment you will not be judged. So atonement theology is also based on the understanding that there is life after death and that there is a judgment and that something about human life doesn't end with the life that goes on. And so that's one system of thought. Okay, and that certainly is described by Lutheran theologians. I have a lot of problems with that. Peter Stendahl, who was a bishop in the Swedish church, had a lot of trouble with it. He said, it seems to me to be an awfully selfish act on the part of Christians. And that's kind of the way I see it too. It's a scapegoat theory, right? But Dr. Eberhardt's contention is that's a misunderstanding of what Old Testament blood rituals were about. They were not appeasement sacrifices. That's Hollywood stuff. But rather, blood was where the life resided. It's one of the reasons Jehovah's Witnesses won't have blood transfusions, because you're taking somebody else's life into your own. Well, on the other hand, when the priest sacrificed the bull in the temple worship ritual and sprinkled blood on the altar and on the people, what they were doing was sprinkling life onto the community, the life that God was giving to them. And so Dr. Eberhardt's contention is that that's what Jesus means in the language of the Eucharist when he says, I give you my blood, I give you my body. He's not saying, I'm going to sacrifice myself on your behalf. Rather, I'm going to give you life so that you can live fully embodying the presence of God and being God's sons and daughters, because that's what I have experienced is the way of relationship with God. So Jesus is handing on to the community that which he has received. And that's what we say also in our Eucharistic theology. And we understand that God is made incarnate in this ritual. And then God lives now, or Jesus lives now, not in some individual person walking the earth that we secretly don't recognize, but lives embodied in the community that's gathered around the word sacrament. Wherever two or three are gathered together, there I am. It means to do. So these are kind of two understandings of what salvation means in Lutheran theology that stand in some dialectic with each other.
St. John Chrysostom said, "You may be the only Christ the stranger ever meets." This profound sense of incarnation. Mona?
No, I'm still absorbing that.
Pardon me?
I'm still absorbing that.
So am I.
Where do you think this substitutionary atonement comes from? I mean, it's such a remarkable idea, and it is curious, because, of course, substitutionary atonement was not the traditional teaching in the Eastern Church. The whole of the Eastern Church rejects this as the worst heresy that ever was perpetrated through the paradigm of Christianity. How could you possibly conceive of a God who you claim is one with Jesus Christ, and look at what he did? He hung on a cross instead of killing anybody. How could you possibly conceive of a God that way? As if God's justice and God's love had to somehow be satisfied through him sending his son into the world and killing him. It's an extraordinary image of child abuse. So, what do you think? Where does it come from? What's going on?
My own bias is that it comes out of the Roman culture of the Western Church. It's based on a Roman system of law, of crime and punishment, and making restitution, atonement, for one's crimes. And so the doctrine of the atonement then became a strong teaching of the Church. Once the Church was the state church of the Roman Empire, and it accumulated considerable power, and so it was one of the ways in which the Church could control the consciences of people and make them dependent on the Church as the sole source of salvation. There's no other salvation outside the Church. That was one of the threats that was used against the Reformers.
David, you bring up an interesting point. You know, when Christianity became the state church of the Roman Empire, it did not affect the theology of the East. Why was that? What happened?
There were two empires, one in the East and one in the West. We forget that the one in the East lasted 1,000 years longer than the one in the West. But the one we know is the one in the West, because Rome was the Western Empire, and the Protestant tradition is a form of the Roman tradition. Do you think there's any more than that, too?
No, I think that's right. And the Reformers only fought the battles they wanted to fight, and so not all of Roman theology was redone in the Reformation churches. And depending on whether the Reformation was Lutheran or Calvinist, different reforms took place as well.
Well, it's Anselm, isn't it? In the Middle Ages that develops that idea.
Based
on God, the feudal lord, whose honor needs to be satisfied in some way. So he says, well, that's why Jesus became human, fully God, fully man.
The metaphor is from the human law court.
So it's even late in the West that doctrine is adopted.
Although atonement theology also appears in Paul's writings. So you can't say it isn't in the scriptures, but Paul was arguing a particular case within a Roman audience that understood Roman law.
And it's what you make of the metaphors, as Abraham has pointed out.
That's right.
This is a huge issue. And we tend to read back into Hebrew Bible those metaphors, I think, in Western thought, from Anselm and the law court.
Yeah.
So the question, I mean, one way of putting it that I'm fond of is, did Jesus come, did the incarnation occur as a legal mission? Or did it occur as a medical mission? Was it about healing? Or was it about judgment? And if you take the Gospels, remove all the healing narratives and see what you got left.
Yeah. Apocalyptic. Death of sinners stories.
I'd just like to kind of clarify my own understanding of agape is that when we practice agape, we leave aside all categories and definitions except the one that we're all human beings. Like that quotation about neither in Christ there's neither
right, that's part of it. That's right.
So that's a big part of it. You lay aside all of that.
Well, you don't have to abandon your humanity, though.
No.
Because part of recognizing all of those things means that you also accept the eroticism and all the loyalties and stuff that each person comes with, no matter how weird they may appear in your culture. But what Paul is saying is that this is the background which, and this is what I'm going to talk about tomorrow, against which all of these other things can find fuller expression there. So when you use a fear love dialectic, then you get all half of the jokes that stand-up comedians tell about the war between the sexes, you know, how different they are and how they can't get along. But if you use agape as the background, then you get stories of romance and caring and enduring love and faithfulness and all of these kinds of things.
And not much comedy.
No, but I can tell you there can be a lot of smiling in it.
That's right. You get joy instead of comedy.
Yeah.
Pat,
you do get joy.
I'm kind of puzzled about, you know, as societies, we live mostly in the world with separation of state and church. And so I continue to struggle with, puzzle about how we live as Christians in the political sphere, or how we take action in the political sphere, given that so much of what is decided there affects people and the nature of society so enormously. So I think of just one example, the travesty for me of the minimum wage as such a profoundly inadequate amount. And it's shameful. And I think about, you know, former students and the parents of some of my former students, and they worked three jobs, and they were working so hard, and they were working full out, and they loved their kids a lot, and they didn't have time to support them with homework and all the different ways that they wanted to and would have liked to if they just couldn't make ends meet. And so I puzzled about the state and the church being separate. We govern without faith in a certain way to be appropriate, politically appropriate. But how do we live our faith in this important realm that touches and influences and causes, you know, a lot of pain for for a lot of the population. I think it's a disadvantage. Yeah, I just wondered, how does agape touch our politics?
This is what my talk is going to be about tomorrow. Let me respond to your specific question. It doesn't matter whether we have separation of church and state, because agape isn't about propagation of religion. It's about living a fully human life. And so what we're talking about is how we, as people of the society, engage in citizenship. And in our citizenship, we reflect the value that we understand human life to have from our religious tradition. So it isn't necessary for a member of the legislature or city council or an administrator of the Department of Welfare to shape the welfare department so that it acts religious. But that person's religion calls upon that person to work for that which is fully human, as compared to a more adversarial system, which is mostly how it works. And it's going to go down again with the budget cuts.
Does that speak to what you're getting at, Pat, or do you want to follow up on that?
It just continues to be a bit haunting for me. At all levels, whatever levels we look at, whether it's federal, provincial, or municipal, it's how to have conversations that lead to reflection of that agape in the everyday. It seems to me exactly what you're saying is true. It isn't just to be religious, it's to have policies that are life-giving and support the breadth of the human society.
It's also to remove the implied fear. The implied fear is that if we give people something that we don't think they'll work hard enough to earn, or they're not worthy enough to earn, then the implied fear is that they're somehow going to impoverish us. That's one of the kinds of fears. So you have to earn what you're given. In spite of the fact that there are all sorts of anomalies, people who get lucky and sell their house for a big bunch of money, and the next folks are forced to move by the company and the housing market is depressed. And so it isn't just about work. But that's one of the kinds of mythologies that's operative in this whole culture of fear. And that causes us then to disengage from those people. And then we stop experiencing them as real human beings with real needs. And that's why Paulo Freire said, God doesn't have an option for the poor because they necessarily deserve it. But they're starving. They need it. And as long as they need it, it has to be given to them. That's what love means. It doesn't mean you improve or anything else. So that's one of the kinds of analysis. The other one is that we've lived with this culture of fear for so long in our materialistic and instrumental society that we have found all kinds of ways to classify people. And one of the things is that we've always classified the poor as somehow being failures and therefore we don't respond. Is there anybody here that's coming tomorrow? Okay, because I didn't need to leave the room. One of them is from the Globe and Mail, and it's a post-Olympic story. The Lutherans and Anglicans and some of the other church groups have an urban mission in Surrey, which is the big city to the south of Vancouver. And what they did is that it's called Surrey Urban Mission. and they operate out of a church building in the city core, and they had a whole bunch of their folks who use their center, accredited by the Olympics. I love the story. And their job was to recycle and to gather compostable materials every night. So they started with 5 o'clock and they worked until 11. It's natural for us. Dumpster divers are used to picking cans up. But the problem they ran into was that the Olympic Committee wasn't sure that these folks should be a legitimate part of the organization. And after they saw it turn out, they changed their mind. So that's a good news story that I'm going to share with Warren. The other one is one of my favorite First Nations comedians, who likes to stand on Portage Avenue in Winnipeg. And he'd like the typical handout artist. And when someone comes walking by, he says, "Hey, come here, huh?" They don't want to make that fun. "Hey, come here, hey, come here." Finally gets them to come over. When they come over, he reaches in his pocket with a handful of change and says, "Want to buy a cup of coffee?" He says, I try never to judge a man by the color of his neck. See, you know, that's the other side. There are ways in which we can enter into each other's humanity. And obviously, the socio-political economics are very complicated. The single act of human kindness isn't going to turn this all around. It's an insidious disease that we live with in our part of the world. But I'm working on an analysis that helps us to understand these. It helps me to understand what it means to be Christian. And how it desentimentalizes love so that it isn't attached to approval and all of those things that make love so icky and so tenuous.
I'd just like to comment drawing on an example of sort of the good news thing in that entering into community. When some community groups in Edmonton were renovating the old Flatiron building as the new home for the Women's Emergency Accommodation Center, I had quite a big honor of doing PR for that event as a volunteer. And one of the things we did was we had a sleepover weekend, the weekend before it opened to women without a place to sleep. Women paid a lot of money to have a slumber party in that building and sort of sleep there where in the Scuzzy neighborhood, where scary things happen and where rich white women don't usually go, and had this experience. And in the stories that the staff told, like many of us had this illusion that, well, yeah, it's really good that there's a place for women who don't have a home to go to at night. But it would never happen to me. And then some of the staff members read some of the postcards from some of the women who had been through the Women's Emergency Accommodation Center over the years. And one never knows what twists and turns of life separate a happy white middle class woman with a career and I need a bed for the night. It was a profoundly moving experience for a lot of women who pay $100 a night to
just to follow up on your remarks about homelessness and what you said about God's preferential option for the poor and the social constraints that we're under that prevent us from acting the way we believe we should. Malcolm Gladwell has an essay on homelessness in which he studies the problem specifically in Southern California and determines that really the core homeless is a very small percentage, and it would be cheap. They eat up most of the resources, and it would be cheaper and better for them to rent an apartment and a full-time nurse. But there's no will to do it because we don't feel it's right to give something without them working for it. I don't have I have to work two jobs. Why should we give an apartment to this person who's living on this?
My hometown, Nanaimo, has replicated that study and come up with the same conclusions. Mm-hmm. But there won't be any political will to do it. Mm-hmm. Because need is so tied to economics that we can't legitimate need just because it's there. Very difficult to achieve that politically.
Yeah. But isn't that because our innate doctrine of atonement, yeah, that all of us carry in our hearts is forensic? You know, it's not a healing issue.
Actually, I want to say that there are two places I know of that have precisely done that. One in Ottawa, which did get funding at first federally, but was cut off. And because it was such a success that the community itself took on a nonprofit organization to continue that program. And in Calgary, which does it because of that success. And interestingly enough, they're getting the funding to reduce the justice system, which is one of the key places that gets cut. So, it's amazing how people who truly have that sense of God can work out to find that away.
Well, thanks. I appreciate talking with you. I think this group understands very well what I've been trying to talk to you about. It's not the only way to understand the scriptures or to understand the Christian faith. So I've been trying to stick just to that one polarity of love and fear, because it's so easy to say love and hate, but that's not the issue. It's much more systemic than that. And that's what I was wanting to talk with you tonight.
You have to be quick around. Yeah, I have a question. Sure. You said fear and love are opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand.
You don't.
They're connected, right? Love and fear are connected.
That's because fear always estranges us from others. I can hate you, but we can still fight. We'll still be engaged. Okay. I might be mad at you, and it might not be a very pleasant relationship, but we'll still be engaged. But fear will cause me either to do you harm or to abandon you. And we will not have a relationship. And then love can't happen.
But then, like in the Bible, right, it says that we should fear God and we should love him.
Yeah. So, okay, the trouble with the English language is that fear can also mean respect and honor.
Okay.
And awe.
Yeah.
The word would be better to say awe. And awe of God is the beginning of wisdom. Yeah. That's what it really means.
So that's okay.
Thanks so much. Good to see you all. I'll just mention briefly that tomorrow night at 7 at Trinity Lutheran Church with Bishop Raymond. Also, two things to mention. We will be announcing on our website a new date for the what I prefer to call what Muslims always wanted to know about Christianity but never dared to ask. We had tentatively scheduled it for the 20th, but some issues in the Muslim community mean that that's not going to happen. But we will announce it on our website. And I'm also hoping that David King, who was going to do a forum as well and became quite ill, that his recovery process has come along enough so that we will be rescheduling that, and we will announce it on the website. And one last thing, we have the latest Ronnie Center publication, which just came out today. You're in luck. On the way to Muslim Christian understanding.
It's the two lectures by Franz Volker Greifenhagen. Mm-hmm. So I have a few copies here. If you don't think you'll be receiving one in the mail, help yourself. Mm-hmm. Lovely to see you. Bye-bye, and thanks again. Thank you.